Hi everyone, I'm Chris Saldana, and this is the National Education Policy Center's Education Interview of the Month. Today we're speaking with Dr. Jennifer Jellison-Holm, an Associate Professor of Educational Policy and Planning in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy at UT Austin, and Dr. Kara Finnegan, Professor of Educational Leadership and Policy in the Warner School's Department of Educational Leadership at the University of Rochester. Drs. Holm and Finnegan are the authors of a new book entitled Striving in Common, A Regional Equity Framework for Urban Schools. In their book, Holm and Finnegan propose a new framework for addressing the inequities experienced by historically underserved communities and students. Jennifer and Kara, thank you for being with us today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So I want to start by asking about the title of your book. You write in your introduction that it really captures your main argument. So what were you trying to convey through your title, and how does it speak to the aims of this book? And how specifically are these aims different from a traditional approach to educational policymaking?
Well, the main argument in our book is that traditional approaches to education policymaking tend to really ignore the larger context in which school systems are operating. So especially some of the dominant approaches like market-based reforms and accountability reforms take not only an acontextual approach to policymaking, but also a relatively competitive approach. So it's often one that tends to blame educators and punishes schools. And so it really often sort of ignores or sidesteps the underlying structural inequalities that we argue contribute to a lot of the educational problems that these traditional approaches are trying to solve. So our title, Striving in Common, is really an effort to capture our main argument about pushing the education policy world to really think about how problems of school failure, and I'm going to put that in quotes, the word failure, are really linked to inequities across regions in terms of segregation, inequalities in school funding. And also, especially a key argument in our book is how the underlying systems of competition between school systems often contribute to these inequities and problems in school systems. So the title of our book really is sort of a bit of a play on words. It turns out that the late Latin root of compete means to strive in common. And so we're really trying to sort of flip that narrative on its head and say, and really argue for a more collaborative, cross-sector, regional approach, multi-district approach to addressing educational inequality. And that is really stands in stark contrast to current approaches, which take a single district, educational only, acontextual, and often competitive approach to policymaking.
You talk about how policymaking is inherently a process that involves design, politics, implementation, and sustainability. And to explain this, you introduce two theories that you draw upon to help your readers make sense of this process. One is civic capacity, and the other is urban regime theory. So I was wondering if you could talk a bit about these theories and how they help you frame your analysis and your policy recommendations.
Well, of course, we're not the first people to think about using political lenses in this area, but we did find it especially useful in thinking about the regional inequities that Dr. Holm was just mentioning. The book starts out really in thinking about using a political geography framework to think about urban inequality and how the political dynamics in a community create a sort of type of racialized spaces. And we draw upon the work of Clarence Stone and Richard Thompson Ford and others to think about the political decision-making and processes that happen along the way to create the inequities we see today. So these theories that you mentioned are helpful both in thinking about the history and also in thinking about what needs to happen next to create greater equity in these communities. So urban regime theories are really helpful for thinking about who is making reform decisions or policy decisions. Often there are coalitions among government actors and what we call business elites and others who are usually in sort of a position of authority. They have networks of connections and they have resources to mobilize. It's sort of the idea of the power elite who are making decisions. And it's important to understand that in communities because it helps you to see how ideas are being framed in terms of the problems and the potential solutions and who's being represented by those decisions. Civic capacity, on the other hand, helps to think about how you build capacity in a community, or whether a community has the type of capacity that can bring about change and sort of alter those power dynamics. So when we think about civic capacity, it's often thinking about whether the community, if there are people in the community that have the ability to interject new ideas into this complex problem and thinking about solutions. And also, there's a way that the capacity of a community involves bringing diverse interests from like a broad segment of the population to solve problems. So usually there is a broader reach in terms of the interests that are represented, and there's an idea of sort of a collective attempt to solve a problem in a new way. That's both of those theories helped us in looking at the communities that were in our research project and ultimately in our book.
So you mentioned the political geographic lens that you apply to this work, and you have these wonderful visual representations throughout the book that really drill the point home, but you point out the particularly pernicious effect of racial housing segregation on public education. So why is housing so important to public education? And contrary to what some may believe, how would you say policy has exacerbated segregation and what you call regional inequity?
Well, housing has been part of the long history of segregation because of some of the policies early on that led to mass suburbanization. So between the federal government and banks, there were opportunities for home loans to white families that led them to move into new communities outside of cities, and also led to a disinvestment in the urban core. And we also talk about in the book how the end of annexation by cities reduced their ability to maintain power structures that involved both the suburban communities and the inner city. And so at the same time, suburbs became separate and autonomous kinds of units. And so there's a way that this separation was happening over time through all of these factors in combination. And then on top of this, the Milliken and Bradley decision in Detroit limited the ability to address some of the inequities that we were seeing through housing in terms of schooling. And so it was no longer permissible to think about any kind of cross-district solutions. And so it just solidified this effect over time in terms of both housing and schooling being resulting in segregation and not having a lot of policy tools to address those things.
So I want to move to the case studies that you highlight in the book. You highlight different communities and both the effects of segregation and regional inequity and how different communities have tried to attend to these challenges. For example, you begin by telling the story of Normandy, Missouri. What about Normandy's story stood out to you?
We thought Normandy was just a really telling example of the issues that we were raising in our book. And many of your listeners have probably had a chance to listen to the podcast, This American Life, the episode titled The Problem We All Live With, which was reported by Nicole Hannah-Jones about kind of the troubles afflicting the Normandy school district. And if they haven't, I'd recommend doing so. But Normandy really is a district that represents many of the issues that Kara was just describing. You know, it's a district that is in a highly segregated metropolitan area. It's in the St. Louis metropolitan area, and it's an inner ring suburb that traditionally had been a working class white suburb that then became highly segregated due to the banking and housing discrimination that Kara had mentioned. And it's important to recognize that the St. Louis metropolitan area is carved up into many different municipalities and also many school districts due to these boundary lines that Kara had been referring to. And it's those boundary lines that really we argue in the book, and we draw on scholarship about this, that reinforce and perpetuate problems of segregation and resource inequality between school districts. So with Normandy, it was a district that is highly segregated, had a very low tax base, and it had really a very little ability to kind of change that situation. So it's an inner ring suburb that's only has 3,100 kids and across 24 very small municipalities. But because of the traditional approaches to policymaking that we had mentioned earlier, it had been a district that had been sort of viewed as to blame for the problems of student achievement that they were facing. So for many years, the state had labeled the district failing through its state accountability system, and which the accountability system had viewed the system at fault and the educators at fault for the problems that Normandy had been facing. And one thing we pointed out in the book is that Normandy, you know, we spoke to the superintendent of Normandy, who said that one of the sort of some of the beginning of their achievement problems was when the district had agreed to absorb a district that had previously been dissolved by the state of Missouri. It wasn't the only all-Black district in the state of Missouri, and no other district agreed to take their students. And so Normandy stepped up and said, "We'll take those kids." And that was sort of one of the beginning of the accountability problems that they faced. And as achievement declined, the district then ended up being put on probation and penalized for its low performance. And then ultimately, because of this acontextual approach of educational policymaking, it was ended up almost going bankrupt for reasons we sort of describe in the book. So again, we think it's a really important illustration of how traditional approaches not only fail to recognize the underlying sources of problems, which is housing segregation and tax-based inequality and the systems of competition between school districts in metropolitan areas that really set up districts like Normandy at a very big structural disadvantage, but that they not only ignore those systems, but then end up ultimately blaming districts and punishing them for their situation. And so it really misses the larger picture and fails to really address the underlying structural causes of these problems. So in our book, we argue that there's a need for an approach that really actually addresses the causes rather than, you know, what we call the symptoms of the structural racism and structural inequality that districts are embedded within.
So you also highlight other communities that have tried varied approaches to attend to the challenges that you just described in Normandy. So for example, East Palo Alto, California, and Rochester, New York, both implemented inter-district desegregation programs. And Minneapolis, St. Paul, Minnesota, and Portland, Oregon, both took an urban policy approach. So how are these communities different from Normandy? What were they trying to accomplish with these policies? And were they successful?
Well, it's a great question. The inter-district programs that you mentioned in East Palo Alto and in Rochester have a similar kind of approach to Normandy, where there was a lot of attention towards the failing schools in the inner city, and but this surrounding districts that have greater resources, and so there's attempt to move some children across those lines. Now, they have different histories in terms of how those policies came about that we talk about in the book, but in the end, it's the same kind of an idea where there's an opportunity to move some children from the city to the suburban areas. And this is just a more narrow approach, as Dr. Holm was talking about, where you have such a narrow view of what the problem is. And in some ways, it became a workaround, we think, in terms of getting at these bigger issues. And so rather than in some places, you know, creating some kind of community-wide solution or metro-wide solution, there was just an effort to kind of move children around, very few, and over time, there was a disinvestment in the cities. And while a few children might have had access to different kinds of resources, it really didn't tackle at all the underlying dynamics. So we see those as, you know, success is really hard. It depends on what you're looking at. It's not to say that some children haven't benefited, but if you're looking at equity and access to high quality programs and resources, particularly for inner city areas that have high rates of poverty, these programs have done little to address any of those issues. So why we bring up other places like Minneapolis and Portland is because there's a different way of thinking about policy change in those areas. And while these are not focused on education policy, as you mentioned, these are broader urban policies. We think it's important to consider, and this is a lot of what we talk about in the book, how these two different areas of education policy and broader urban policy have not really been speaking to each other or learning from each other enough, we think. So in those other communities, the community, the collective idea that I was mentioning around using those frames earlier, it became the metropolitan area and thinking about redistribution of resources in the broader metro area. And so what that means is that when those communities were making decisions about economic development or housing or transportation or things like that, they wouldn't limit it to those boundaries of the smaller communities like we do in education policy. They would think regionally, and that's a different kind of approach that then allows you to think about anything that happens in one part of the region benefits or harms the other parts of the regions. And so you want to create a system that looks more collectively and equitable across the whole region rather than thinking about them as separate parts.
And if you don't mind, I'll jump in here that, you know, one of the things we highlight is that the regional efforts in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and also Portland, Oregon, we sort of say that they're interesting models because they do take this regional approach, sort of recognizing that if certain communities are suffering in the region, it's collectively going to be sort of harmful for the growth of the entire region. But it fails to include education policy within their approach. And the interdistrict programs that Kara is discussing, as she mentioned, there are educational policies that don't include housing and tax-based inequality in their approaches. And so, as Kara was mentioning, we sort of argue for this need to bridge these two kinds of approaches so that we think both are very worthwhile, but they need to be connected and they need to be specifically oriented on the issue of equity so that districts across the region are all working collectively and benefiting from the growth in the region. So, these boundaries are sort of artificial that separate communities, but they have real consequences for kids and opportunity. And so how can you reshape that is the question that we ask.
So you also highlight Omaha public schools. So how is Omaha, or I guess I should say, how was Omaha unique in its approach?
Right. So as you kind of referred to, Omaha's effort was in existence for a relatively somewhat brief period of time, and some core elements of that model that we hold up have since been undone due to a lot of the political dynamics that we describe in the book and in our framework around political geography. But they were actually able to be enacted in the first place due to other elements like civic capacity and the urban regime theory that we talk about. But Omaha is an interesting place because it's one of the first, if not only, regional educational approaches in education. So it really exemplifies a lot of the elements that we think are worthwhile and that really do address some of the underlying problems we've been talking about. So the elements that Omaha was trying to address is the fact that the urban school system had been growing more and more high poverty. Its tax base was suffering as more and more kids either transferred out of the district or moved out of the district. And so suburban districts in the area were, segregation was growing between the urban and suburban districts, and as well as resource inequality. And so due to a series of events, they created this regional collaborative approach to try to address these underlying inequities and segregation by creating four things that we talk about in the book. One is a regional governing body across all districts across two counties in the Omaha area. So it's a governing body consisted of both elected and appointed officials that represent all the different communities in the area. It entails tax-based sharing. So instead of having this competitive system of relationships where some districts are able to hoard resources by, zoning out low-income housing, for example, in this case, they pooled resources across all communities and redistributed it according to student population and need. It also entailed investments in high poverty communities, so really targeted investments for communities where there were large numbers of low-income families, such as particularly early childhood education. But it also incorporated what we call mobility policy, which is like the inter-district integration programs. So it allowed students to choose more racially and economically diverse schools. And so those are four really key elements that we think really can help to begin to break down these underlying structural barriers that we identify in the book. But the one limit to the Omaha policy is that we point out that it doesn't incorporate anything really beyond education. And so we argue in the book for a fifth element, which is these cross-sector approaches. So coordinating with housing authorities, transit, economic development. So really needing to cross, to dialogue across these often siloed disciplinary and policy boundaries. But we think that those five elements together are a framework that will really begin to tackle some of these underlying inequities that we identify.
So going back to theories of civic capacity and urban regimes that we discussed earlier, what do you see as the preliminary steps that communities can take to move towards policy frameworks that promote regional equity?
Well, as Jen was just describing, there's a way that we saw in Omaha where the group of people who came together to identify a new way of thinking about these problems had a shared vision for change. They were able to persuade people in the community a little bit of a different way of thinking about what level the community is and these ideas around regional equity that we were talking about, and how there's a way that it's not a zero-sum game that, like many people, position these kinds of decisions. They also had a pretty wide coalition in terms of the people involved in thinking about this change process. And that would be critical, as I mentioned before, in terms of thinking about having new voices and new ideas enter these kinds of policy debates. Because there's a way that, as we talk about the problems in inner city schools have been defined, sort of blaming those communities and those students. And so there's a reframing that has to happen, a redefinition of what has caused those situations over time that brings in a broader lens than people have been using in the past. So coalitions are critical in terms of different groups being involved and not just the power structures that tend to exist in communities. And it really can be helpful also to have some kind of champion, sort of the policy entrepreneur idea, where you have one or two people who will go out on a limb and try to really stake a claim that there has to be something different that happens. These are longstanding problems that have gotten worse over time, and we need some new solutions to really bring about equity and get at the core issues that we were talking about earlier. And also a focus on racial equity and justice. Sometimes decisions are made with sort of a colorblind approach, and that's not going to solve some of these issues that are longstanding in communities that involve racism, frankly, from decisions around redlining and things like that that caused the segregation to begin with. And also this idea of thinking about a cross-sectional coalition or collaboration. So we tend to always think about education policy on its own. And there's really a time now to think about how transportation and health policy and environmental policy, all of these things go hand in hand. So of course, housing, which we already have talked about. So thinking about cross-sectional strategies also will move us forward. But we do talk about a lot in the book how local interests are what get in the way of these of change in terms of thinking about new policy strategies. And those are very hard to overcome. And so in the end of our book, we talk about some of this, the ways that state or federal government might need to be involved to help to push some of these strategies on the ground and encourage all of these areas of cross-sectional collaboration and metropolitan equity that we're talking about. And so in the end, in terms of, you know, taking steps in a community, there's really a need to alter the power dynamics by creating a diverse coalition through broader representation and also through activism. So we did see some of that, and that I think is at the core of some of the work going on in many communities around the country today. So I think there's a hopeful point in time where people are really finally starting to address these underlying issues, and our book, we hope, can help to move people forward in that direction.
Thank you, Dr. Holm and Dr. Finnegan. Your book is a wonderful resource for policy scholars, policymakers, and community members interested in improving both their communities and public schools. Again, Dr. Holm and Dr. Finnegan's book is Striving in Common, a regional equity framework for urban schools. Next month, we'll be speaking with Dr. Ansley T. Erickson and Dr. Ernest Morell, the editors of a new volume entitled Educating Harlem, A Century of Schooling and Resistance in a Black Community. The volume traces the varied ways that Harlem residents defined and pursued educational justice for their children and community despite consistent neglect and structural oppression. Educating Harlem brings together a multidisciplinary group of scholars to provide a broad consideration of the history of schooling in perhaps the nation's most iconic Black community. As always, thanks for listening, and remember that for the latest analysis on education policy, you should subscribe to the NEPC newsletter at nepc.colorado.edu and follow NEPC on Twitter at NEPCTweet.